Fearless Report. And now your host, John Friend.
All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, August 27th, 2020. Of course, my website is therealistreport.com, where you will find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio programs I've participated in. You will also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded in the right-hand sidebar of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly revisionist history magazine. Please consider subscribing to these fine print publications if you do not already. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for all the details. All right, let me introduce our special guest this evening. Dr. Kevin McDonald is joining us once again. Dr. McDonald is the editor of the Occidental Observer website and the Occidental Quarterly magazine, and has written numerous books over the years. Dr. McDonald, welcome back to the program, sir. How are you this evening?
I'm just fine, John. Good to be back.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it. It's a lot has happened in these past 6-7 months, and it's been about a year and a half since the last time you were on the program, so There's definitely a lot to talk about.
It's almost like a different world, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. It's insane. I wanted to start out. You've been a guest on the program a number of times, and we've discussed a number of issues. Especially, you know, one of the major themes is always your book Culture Critique, and the role that the organized Jewish community plays not only in America but really across the wider Western world. You know, how they use their power and influence to manipulate our societies to basically advance their own interests, to the detriment of white America, essentially. And I read your foreword to Brenton Sanders' new book, Battle Lines, Essays on Western Culture, Jewish Influence, and Anti-Semitism, which I thought was excellent. I have not read this book, obviously. I think it was just recently published.
It just
came out. So I haven't bought a copy of it. You know, obviously, I would encourage people to check it out. Your website is theoccidentalobserver.net, and I subscribe to you guys' newsletter. So every time there's a post that comes out on your website, I get an email, you know, with a link and a little blurb of the article. So that's one way I stay up to speed with the work that you do. You're also on Twitter. I believe it's at @TOOEdit, if I'm not mistaken. That's your Twitter handle. Yeah. And I wanted to read just a brief excerpt of your foreword, because I think it really kind of summarizes the importance of your work and, you know, some of the conversations that we've had over the years and a lot of the writing and podcasts and stuff I've done over the years as well. And you say here, this is, and again, the foreword, this is just a brief excerpt. You say here, the general theme of Battle Lines is the difficult question of Jewish influence. Difficult, at least partly, because the literature is littered with apologetic writings, so that getting a firm grasp on such a topic requires great persistence and honesty. As he writes in the introduction, and you're referring to Sanderson here, the Jewish question is foundational to the demographic transformation of the West, the revolution in its sexual and ethical mores, and to the trajectory of Western politics, art, and culture. We can't avoid talking about it if we want to be honest about what is happening, but doing so is a thankless task, a reason for being scorned and ostracized, fired from one's job, barred from influential positions in the media and academic world. Sanderson quotes Richard Wagner, writing in the 19th century, quote, "It is distressing to me always to come back to the theme of the Jews, but one cannot escape it if one looks to the future." And 150 years after Wagner's statement, it is still absolutely true. We simply can't avoid discussing the Jews. Honest discussions of Jewish influence are absolutely necessary if white people are going to have a future. And your foreword continues, but I thought that was a very, very powerful section of the foreword, and I couldn't agree with you more. You really can't understand anything that's going on if you're not understanding the role of the organized Jewish community and how it wields its power and influence in society. It's absolutely central to understanding the plight of whites and how we got to where we are right now. Our country is literally falling apart. Whites have been systematically disenfranchised and displaced. We have no political or social or racial representation. And most people, in fact, have a negative perception of their white identity, if they even do care about the concept or are concerned about the concept of race. So it's really, an incredible situation. And, knowing all these things after all these years, I'm still just dumbfounded by it all, that we literally can't even, talk about the role that Jews have played in all of this without, again, being ostracized, fired from your job, which has happened to me a couple of times in the past. So, and I mean, you've been through it, and, when you were a professor at Cal State Long Beach. So it's a very, the most controversial topic in our society, but it's the one that we need to be addressing if we want to understand what the heck is going on.
It's so true. And, they hold an awful lot of the high cards. And, this whole sort of revolution that we're seeing in the streets, Black Lives Matter and the Antifa and all that, it's misleading in the sense that you see all these poor people, these poor blacks in the cities, and these Antifa guys who are pretty much a bunch of losers, really. They a lot of them, really don't have steady jobs, and they're taking drugs or mental issues or whatever. But it's hard to notice or really understand that this is a top-down thing. This is an elite project. And, this is blessed by all the big media, the Democratic Party, essentially. I guess Joe Biden finally came out and said something today. But the Democratic politicians have had many, many opportunities to condemn the violence. And those cities are run by Democrats, huge majorities, and they're going up in flames. And Black Lives Matter is getting tens of millions of dollars from Apple and other big corporations. So this is not a bottom-up kind of thing. It is done with the blessing of our elites. And you cannot understand American elites now without understanding Jews. They are a very substantial percentage. And just in terms of billionaires, they're probably 35% of Jewish billionaires. Well, that is a big enough number. And you got to realize that most of those Jews are very much involved in politics in a way that non-Jews are not, and tend not to be. And they contribute a huge amount of money to the Democrats and the Republicans. So, they contribute the amount of money that they are contributing to the political process. Cannot be ignored, is not ignored. And so what you see is wars on behalf of Israel, and generally we're enacting the hatred that Jewish intellectuals have had for the West for centuries, because it's really part of the Jewish education when they're kids. They grow up thinking, hear about the Middle Ages, they don't think about, knights and cathedrals and all that. They think of Jews being expelled from much of Western Europe at different times. And so they hate the West. They hate us. They hate America as it was. They hate the America I grew up in, and feel very fortunate actually to have been born at really in a golden age. You're a lot younger than I am. I worry about you, people your age, growing old in this society, because it is increasingly no society for whites, and especially for white men, is rapidly transforming.
Yeah, it's insane. You know, I commented on this on a recent podcast I did last weekend. I was watching some videos on YouTube, and it's old video clips of like Los Angeles, for example, New York City, and other big cities in America. And it's just amazing. I mean, how orderly and clean, and you know, that there was harmony, and it was, you know, again, this is when America was white. And now you look at most major cities, and they're up in flames, and businesses are being looted, and the entire political and media establishment, by and large, is on board with this and is justifying it or making excuses for it, and, you know, basically incentivizing it. And that's a topic that is a major theme of your website, how the sort of anti-white program is incentivized at all levels of society. And we see this play out in a number of different ways, which, you know, we've talked about, and we'll probably talk about in this podcast. But literally the anti-white agenda in this country and in really every Western country is incentivized by the government. So essentially what we're dealing with is whites are living as stateless people. I heard Eric Stryker and Mike Enoch talk about this concept, and it really is a good way of understanding the situation. We do not have a state that represents our interests. We have a state that is totally controlled by hostile elites, and the organized Jewish community makes up a huge portion of that, right? I mean, there's no denying that. You know, you can just look at the facts and the figures, look at Jewish publications, you know, explicitly that will say this and admit it, and then on the other hand denounce you as an anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist for pointing it out.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that hostility towards the white and white males is incentivized. I mean, that's the big thing. I mean, they have created a culture that is hostile to us and is very you know, very lucrative for people who want to get on board with it. I mean, if you're an academic, and say you're ambitious and you want to be a dean, well, there's no way you can do that without signaling all kinds of diversity stuff. And you probably have to be homosexual. You probably have to, you know, really, if you're white, you know, and of course you're going to get passed over for all kinds of non-whites. But if you are white, you know, you better really show your stripes when it comes to these issues, and knuckle under. But yeah, you know, that's the thing. We have wealthy people on our side, but you can't find any of them. I shouldn't say that. They're not on our side, but they are not Jewish, and they are white. People white. Jeff Bezos is a good example, and his actual name that he's born with is Jorgensen. He's, you know, Northern European, Norwegian, or Scandinavian heritage, and his mother married someone named Bezos after that. But, you know, he's bought the Washington Post, which is just obsessively anti-Trump and anti-white and just, you know, just crazy. And Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, I mean, you name them. They're not on board with us.
Go ahead.
Well, whereas these Jewish billionaires tend to be activists, and many of them. People like, George Soros is sort of paradigmatic there, but there are many, many, many others. If you look like Bloomberg, and he, you know, he used to call himself a Republican, but, and then there's Steiner, you know, very big in donating for Israel and AIPAC and all of that. So if you want a good career in the swamp in Washington, you know, you know where the money is. And I was thinking of someone like John Bolton. He's not Jewish, but he knew where the money was in Washington. And he sets up this think tank, Center for Security Policy, and, you know, it's gung-ho pro-Israel and all that, and he's well funded. He ended up with getting a position in the Trump administration, you know, via Sheldon Adelson, who's, you know, totally committed to Israel. You know, he once said something like, You know, he had never served in the military, but if he had, he wished he had served in the Israeli Defense Force. You know, he's an Israeli patriot living in Las Vegas, you know, worth billions and billions of dollars. And, his support is entirely contingent on supporting Israel. So that's what happens. And Trump, I think Ailson contributed like $200 million to various Republicans, an awful lot to Trump. But I guess they've had a falling out because Trump did not attack Iraq. You know, Trump, certainly has done a lot for Israel, but he has not done the final thing that they really wanted to do, and that is attack Iran. And bomb Iran. And of course that would be an absolute disaster. Trump campaigned on isolationism. And, I guess Sheldon Adelson now is sort of, souring on Trump, not giving him anywhere near as much money as he did last time. Despite what all that Trump's done for Israel, it's astonishing.
Yeah, it is. And you know, you look at the left wing in America, the Democrat Party. They like basically openly hate white people, hate white history, white culture, everything about whites, right? I mean, they're open about it. Meanwhile, on the right, the mainstream GOP and the mainstream, you know, conservative establishment, they think that, you know, they're above identity politics and, you know, they don't think in racial terms because that's what the left does, you know, all that sort of nonsense. Meanwhile, all around them, all throughout society, minorities led by the organized Jewish community in many cases are openly and proudly pursuing their own unique racial interests at the expense of whites. And, you know, you're talking about some of these, like, Jewish elites. And not only the Jewish elites, but, I mean, you look at, like the Jewish community in America, or really anywhere, you know, anywhere in the West, and even in Israel, they have, like, a very, very strong sense of their Jewish identity. At least most of them. I mean, there might be a few exceptions, but you know, you talk to them, and there's public opinion surveys that demonstrate this. Most Jews identify very strongly with their Jewish identity, whether that's, you know, whether they view it as like a racial thing or a religious thing or, you know, an ethnic thing, whatever. Yeah, I mean, the Jews are a very distinct group of people, and they recognize that. They're proud of that. They're very passionate about the Jewish people and, you know, their interests. And, you know, you mentioned how their collective historical identity is framed around this deep-seated hostility to white Western Christian civilization going back centuries where, yeah. You know, they literally, like, they're still up in arms about, you know, alleged Jewish pogroms that took place in whatever European country. I mean, that's how they view history as one big pogrom against the Jews who didn't do anything wrong, right? I mean, they're always like these harmless, benevolent, just oppressed people, right? You know, meanwhile, they're the one that, I don't know, there's much more to the story, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It's not the fact, or it's not the case that the Jews were just, you know, these innocent people that were just being oppressed. In many cases, the consequences that they experienced were a direct result of their own actions, right? I mean, I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
A whole lot of that.
But, yeah. Maybe not all of them, but, you know, it's just
incredible. It's about Jewish identity, Jewish education. You read the Talmud, and there's just so much hatred towards non-Jews and, you know, the desire to dominate and the resentment. And, you know, they still have memories about, you know, the burning of the temple by the Romans. They still have, you know, they'll be taught about the pogroms in Russia in a very distorted way, of course. And as you say, they're never going to blame themselves. They're never going to talk about how their behavior might have angered people. But that's Jewishness for you. And in the Holocaust now, it's a big part of Jewish identity is this sort of sense of persecution, over and over again, and hatred towards the people of the West.
Well, you know, some of the public opinion polls that I mentioned, I mean, Jews are asked how do they identify as Jewish? Like, what is the most important aspect of their Jewish identity? And I think, if I'm not, at least the last time I looked into this, last time I checked, it is like remembrance of the Holocaust. That's like what makes, you know, what makes a Jew. It's like that's their most important aspect of their Jewish identity. So it shows you how deeply rooted this all is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is absolutely pervasive among Jews. Well, you know, not all Jews, but the activists. This is the mindset of the activist Jewish community. And they're the ones that are pulling the wagon here. They're the ones who are dominating Jewish politics. They're the ones that are setting up organizations like the ADL, getting huge funding. You think about how much money the ADL gets in a year. It just dwarfs the total, sum total of contributions to people like us. I mean, it's just massive. And, you know, the ADL then is integrated with police departments. They are, you know, integrated with YouTube and these other social media companies and actively campaigning for censorship and being very, very influential in that regard. So that's what we're up against. I mean, these people are the establishment. They act like they're the persecuted little minority or something, but they're the ones that are clamping down on free speech and, putting huge pressure on social media companies now. I mean, this was the big leap. I mean, back in the 1980s, the only way to get a word out, like that you and I might have these ideas, would be to, you know, send out a newsletter in a brown paper bag or something. Now that we had social media, but they understand this is hugely dangerous, and they're doing everything they can. Andrew Joyce has sort of a definitive article on it. It's really about how it's, the ADL is cooperating with the European Jewish Congress and really trying to, and very effectively, shutting down free speech. They don't believe free speech at all. It means nothing to them.
Yeah, I know. This is something that they've been doing for a very long time. And I mean, you can even go to the ADL's website and they will openly talk about how they collaborate with Facebook and Instagram and YouTube. And I mean, basically like dictate policy to them and tell them like, look, this is what you need to do. This is who you need to ban. In fact, I mean, it was bound to happen, right? I mean, the ADL put out a list of, you know, quote-unquote anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist channels that were still active on YouTube. Every single person on that list has been banned from YouTube as we speak right now. You know, and meanwhile, they want to pretend like they have no power, they have no influence, they're just this, you know, persecuted minority. You know, it's like, it's a joke, it's insulting. And, you know, this is the world that we live in, you know?
This is it, and talk about all this. I mean, I did a lot of research on personality and various things in my academic career. There's a place called ResearchGate where you put all your academic papers. Well, someone complained because I put some of my Jewish papers up there. And all of a sudden, this ResearchGate just completely locked my account. So people cannot see my research on personality or anything, much less Jewish stuff. I mean, this is part of this just complete lockdown, stifling of free speech, stifling of thought, and penalizing anyone. I mean, you know, mostly it's not just us. I mean, either you wear a MAGA hat in Washington D.C. on the streets, you're going to be attacked probably. The very mainstream conservatives can lose their job for saying they're too sexist or saying white lives matter. You know, that's the thing. I mean, it's pervasive and it's getting worse. And, I just, you know, sometimes I don't see a good end game for this. You know, I really don't.
Yeah, I hear you on that. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you, because, you know, you look at all this and how it's happened, and really I think you really see this sort of ascendancy of, like, the organized Jewish community leading up to World War II, and then certainly after World War II, the triumph of the Allies over the evil Nazis and Hitler. And yeah. Really, this is when, you know, they come out of the woodwork. It's not a secret anymore. The Jews are openly running the media, running Hollywood, running academia, running this, running that. You know, you can't say anything about it, of course, because that's anti-Semitic. But, you know, we're going to continue to carry on and proudly identify as Jews and pursue our own interests and instigate and organize all these other minorities to pursue their own unique interests against the white majority, which is rapidly becoming another minority in this totally, you know, multicultural communist, you know, empire that is America now. It's not even a nation. And so, I mean, really, I think that's what this is all about. They really kind of took control of society fully following World War II. And they've made it, you know, we were talking about how the anti-white system is incentivized. They've made it impossible for any decent, honest white person to stand up and champion the interests of whites. You know, they will ruin you, whether you're like a nobody like me, or certainly if you have like a business and you're established and you have some money and some wealth and some influence in the community or whatever. You couldn't get up and start saying these things. They'd ruin your life. They'd take your business. They'd get you fired. They might even arrest you. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like that bad now. And but my point is that it's been like this for a while, going back, I think, to World War II. At least that's my opinion. I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, that's what I just published a book, Individuals in the Western Liberal Tradition. And, you know, I would say that the West really was in charge of its own culture through the 19th century into the 20th century. But even in the 1920s and 30s, there were, you know, so I document how things were changing, people who formerly talked about race and eugenics stopped talking about it at that time. People were sort of tiptoeing around Jewish issues even in the 1920s. But you did have people like Father Coughlin in the 1930s, who they shut him down. And then after World War II, you say Jewish power just took off after World War II. There was no, anti-Semitism went to zero, basically in this country, except for very few people on the fringes. Before World War II, anti-Semitism was very common. Among Europeans and Americans, people were, distrustful, hostile towards Jews. I mean, it's quite common mainstream, to have the opinion say that Jews were deeply involved in the Bolshevik Revolution, that, they were involved in the mass murder in the Soviet Union and things like that. That was just very common. But after World War II, it just went away. And, but the real rise to power, though, I think happened in the 1960s. And that's when Jewish power really, really broke through with the 1965 immigration law, the civil rights movement, with all those things that happened in the 60s, the sexual revolution, all those things. That's really my book, The Culture Critique. And since then, you know, it's just been continuing and in rising. I'd say that it's now more than ever. I mean, so many of the big tech executives are Jewish. You know, Google, both Sergey Brin and Larry Page, I think, are both Jewish. I think Page is only part Jewish. But you look at Facebook with Zuckerberg, and who practically really stole the whole thing from non-Jews. And then you got Twitter, this guy Dorsey, he's donating millions to causes like Black Lives Matter. So, you know, I don't know, you know, it's just, again, it's very hard to see, where we're going. And,
I hear you. You know, I wanted to ask you, are you familiar with a book called The Jewish Threat, Anti-Semitic Politics of the American Army, published by a Jewish professor, Joseph Burdent, what is it?
Bendersky.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
I thought he's not Jewish. I thought he was.
Oh, is he not Jewish? Okay, wow, my mistake then.
I've got a review of that book. I guess you can't get it on ResearchGate anymore, but you can get it on my website. And it's a very good book. And obviously, it's typical. You know, a lot of American military officers have very negative views about Jews. They thought of Jews as deeply involved in communism and subversion. And I wish they were. I mean, they were the backbone of the Communist Party, through the 1950s, and the backbone of sort of left communist sympathetic, people in Hollywood and all that. So American military officers knew that. But again, you had, kind of a purge and, these ideas that had been common, say, in the 1930s just disappeared after World War II.
Yeah, well, they made it very difficult for anybody to publicly espouse these sorts of views, right?
Right.
I mean, they'd basically ruin your life, get you fired, whatever, shut down your business, whatever the case is. But yeah, you know, I have this book. I haven't read the whole thing. I really need to sit down and read the whole thing. I've read a lot of it. And it is incredible. I mean, these guys in our army and a lot of them even in the government and most, you know, sort of well-to-do people in America, they knew exactly what was going on with the Jews. And they certainly understood their role in the communist revolution in Russia and just their, again, as you said, like their promotion of subversion and degeneracy and just their role in like left-wing causes in general.
Absolutely.
And it's interesting too, because I mean, like even like the Protocols of Zion, I mean, you know, a lot of people think of that as like this, according to the ADL, like an anti-Semitic canard, an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. But I mean, back in the day, people read this and took it seriously. And they were like, look, this is exactly what's going on. I don't know if you saw that tweet that was put out by the FBI, vault page. Yeah. The FBI like tweeted out some declassified documents about the protocols, and that, you know, it wasn't even, they didn't even like opine upon it. They just, you know, posted the link to the PDF, and they've had to apologize and everything, but it gives you a good insight into like the seriousness that people took this. And you know, I'd encourage anybody to sit down and read the protocols, and you tell me if there's any truth to them or not, you know. It's pretty clear that there's a lot to it.
Well, even back in 1920, when the protocols were a big deal, people like Henry Ford said, "Well, I don't know if they were actually written by some, you know, Jewish elder or something." But what we do know is that this is what we're seeing.
Exactly.
That's sort of the line that defenders of the protocols take. That even if it's a forgery of some kind. By the way, it's an odd forgery, to say the least. I haven't, you know, studied it, but the way it's phrased and everything, it's just very kind of odd, shall we say. But the fact is, people were saying that it may be a forgery, but who cares? But this is really what's happening here. Whatever wrote this sort of understood Jewish power and what they were trying to achieve. And that's what we're seeing now in the 1920s. That's Henry Ford was, Henry Ford's another good example. Someone who was an elite American. Part of my recent book, I talked about these very elite Americans around 1920. Or in 1910, presidents of Stanford University, professors at the University of Wisconsin, Ivy League professors into eugenics. And that all disappeared. But Henry Ford was a great example. You know, he signed on to all the anti-Jewish stuff. He funded this newspaper, the Dearborn Independent. And, it was written by a couple of journalists. I reviewed that as well. It's on my website. And, it's really a compendium of, what people thought of Jews at that time. They talked about Jews in the liquor business, talked about Jews in the theater business, talked about Jews in the movies, talked about Jews in communism, talked about how Jewish department stores would advertise at the New York Times and stuff like that. And there's this sort of cooperation among Jews and sort of mutual back scratching and all that. It was a very interesting series, actually. I thought it was very well done. It was good journalism. Then he got erased, you know.
Look at the Ford Foundation today and the causes that it champions and funds. I mean, it's a total left wing. They probably support BLM. I don't know that for sure, but I mean, I wouldn't be surprised.
You know, back in the 90s, was it the 90s or before that, where they had this Holocaust series. I think it was the 70s, kind of thing. They had a Holocaust series, a long thing. And it was then sponsored by the Ford Motor Company. And that was like contrition for having this history of anti-Semitism.
Right. They had to atone for their anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, which in many cases were just stating basic and easily demonstrable facts about Jews and what they were up to and some of the things that they were pushing and promoting in American society.
They're definitely not interested in the truth. They are, you know, interested in winning. And that's the thing about Jews. They don't have any principles, as I think a lot of white people understand. Like a lot of conservatives, especially, very principled people, they'll die with their principles and their boots on. Well, Jews are never that way. They have no principles. They just want to win. And whatever it takes, whatever their interests are, they will pursue those interests. And, because, you know, they don't have the foolish ideas that a lot of Westerners have, sort of principled, moral, attitudes. Instead, you know, free speech is a good example. Back in the 1950s, Jewish organizations were in the forefront of free speech. Why? Because Jews were being hauled up in front of these anti-communist committees in Congress, like McCarthy, the House Un-American Activities Committee. And Jewish organizations were all for free speech, and we can't have professors being forced to sign loyalty oaths and all that. Nowadays, Jewish organizations are totally in favor of censorship. And they are in Europe, and they are in America. And they hate the First Amendment, and they would love to be able to get around it and put people like you and me in prison. That is where they are headed. They don't want, they don't want free speech. And they want penalties at law, not just, you know, informal penalties like I call up your boss, or they call up your boss and get you fired. That's not as good as having you put away for a few years in prison for your speech. Well, that's where it's headed. That's what they want. And
No doubt. Go ahead.
More Supreme Court justices than they could do it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, we're already living in sort of like an anarcho-tyranny where law-abiding citizens, people that are simply trying to defend themselves, are being prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, while, you know, violent, totally lawless terrorists can just loot and pillage and rob and rape and steal, you know, basically without any sort of consequences. And that kind of brings me to the next topic I wanted to kind of wrap up the show with. We'll probably need at least another 20 minutes to talk about this. The recent chaos and terrorism in American cities following the death of George Floyd, which is, I mean, geez, it's been, what, almost 3 months? I think it was, what was it? It's been 3 months since that situation, which was totally, of course, totally distorted by the media. Let's be clear about what happened with George Floyd. George Floyd was a career criminal. He attempted to pass a counterfeit bill. He was high out of his mind, which is why he died, in fact. And that's what, what's going to happen. I have a feeling that this is, I hate to be too conspiratorial, but it's almost like it's part of the plan. Because these cops, you know, you look at the body cam footage that's come out, And it's pretty clear to me that these cops are trying to, like, deal professionally and, like, have some sympathy with this guy, because they could tell he was totally, totally bombed out of his mind on drugs. I don't think they knew at the time what he was on, but it came out in the autopsy that he basically overdosed on fentanyl and methamphetamines, from what I understand. He was in very poor physical health, obviously. As I mentioned, he was basically a career criminal, a career drug user, drug dealer, in fact, if I'm not mistaken. So this was not, you know, a good guy by any means. And he resisted with the police officers as soon as they encountered him. Basically, he was not cooperating. Just like none of these people ever cooperate with the cops, ever. And, you know, they didn't even really do anything to him. I mean, if you see the body cam footage, they're trying to get him into the cop car, and then he's, like, asking them, begging them, put me on the ground. So they put him on the ground where he died. And they didn't use any lethal force against him. He died because of a drug overdose. And that's what the medical examiner of the county has concluded, basically. And that's what their defense is going to be. And they're gonna win. I mean, and unless, you know, it's just, we just really have no objective rule of law in America anymore, which, I mean, obviously we don't, but I mean, I just don't see how these guys are gonna get convicted of murder. I mean, give me a break.
Right, and they certainly will be prosecuted. You got Keith Ellis in Minneapolis and Minnesota as attorney general. I mean, they're gonna charge these guys, but yeah, a reasonable jury is not gonna convict when they see the medical evidence. Same in Kenosha, that this kid, it looks like is going to be a good grounds for self-defense. Again, you don't know what the jury's going to do. It's a difficult
now,
situation.
You're referring to Kyle Rittenhouser, I believe that's his name. Yeah. Rittenhouse. Yeah. And by the way, he was the guy, he was 17 years old. He was from a nearby town in Illinois. So, I mean, they're making a big deal about the fact that, one, he crossed a state line, and two, he's 17 years old. Apparently, from what I understand, I have not totally confirmed this, but in order to carry a rifle legally in Wisconsin, you have to be 18 years old. So technically, I guess he did break the law, if that is the case. And he did technically cross a state line. But if you look at a map, I mean, Antioch, Illinois, where he's from, is, you know, literally right across the border from Kenosha. Kenosha, Wisconsin is right near the border with Illinois. So it's basically the same, it's like the same metro area. And yeah. I tweeted a video out. I saw this on YouTube. I'd be shocked if it was still available on YouTube right now, given the, you know, the censorship agenda. Let me see if I can find it really quick. It was basically like a breakdown of every angle of the footage of you know, him shooting these people that were attacking him. And you could go, you know, people really do I would encourage everybody to investigate this and check it out. Look at some of the live streams, look at some of the videos that have come out. There's no way that this kid could be prosecuted for intentional homicide, because that's what he's being charged with right now.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, oh yeah, here it is. It's every angle plus timeline of Kyle Rittenhouse Kenosha riot shooting. You can find it on my Twitter feed, but if you just Google that. Yeah, if you Google it, you could probably find it too. And watch it. I mean, it's really interesting, because I was confused about what exactly happened, and this guy kind of goes through and shows you everything and you know, kind of describes exactly what's going on. And it's clear that he was, I mean, and see, this is the thing. He was, again, he's 17. He probably shouldn't have been out there with a firearm trying to protect the businesses, which is what he said he was there to do, you know, to prevent the looting and the destruction that they'd seen in previous nights.
What had to if the governor had done his job and the mayor, if they sent the National Guard enough troops and the police got serious about it, it never would have happened.
Exactly, and that's exactly what Tucker Carlson said last night, and now, of course, there's an outrage mob against him, as always.
Right.
Yeah, it's really incredible. I mean, the way that these I mean, seemingly like straightforward. clearly, I mean, objectively, I should say, objectively, like the police officers are already operating in a very difficult situation, regardless of where they go. These black people are like just totally out of control. They think they can do whatever the hell they want, and they can resist arrest and not cooperate. And they've basically, the media has basically spun everything into a situation where like enforcing the law is racist. You know what I mean? Like that's basically where we're at right now.
That's the thing, you know, it's almost like, you know, blacks are prone to crime and things like that. So they're making crime, you know, easier, less likely to have negative consequences, and it's hard to arrest, and so on. So you're going to have increases in crime, but that's what they want, really. I mean, they don't want so many black people in prison. They know that, you know, you go to any prison and blacks are hugely overrepresented. Why? Because they commit so many crimes. Well, they want to change that. And their solution, get rid of prisons. Get rid of police. And, somehow, magically, the world's going to be a nice place full of peace and harmony and love. Well, good luck.
Well, and you know, most people, even like some Democrats, I think, would say that even that is like total fantasy. And we need some sort of law and order, right? But I mean, the far left. I mean, yeah, they're definitely pushing this. The people out in the streets, the Antifa and the Black Lives Matter. I mean, these are basically the foot soldiers of this elite agenda, right? I mean, as you said, it's like this elite top down system where these people are out there doing the bidding of the people trying to undermine and destroy the country.
Yeah, it's a top-down revolution. And the thing is, the black situation is basically insoluble. I mean, you have this big black middle class. They were given all these opportunities. And they have, you know, there's a lot of blacks that benefit from this. But you've got this sizable percentage of blacks that are just not going to benefit. They can't get out of, really can't get out of grade school. They can't, hope to hold a responsible job. And, they're prone to crime, drug abuse, all these things. And, you know, we've had 50 years of programs to try to correct this. Nothing has changed. I mean, the education establishment, they've tried every, you know, all these faddish things. At first they claim all the success. You know, blacks and whites are really the same after all. And then, no, it doesn't pan out. And,
because we're not operating in the real world. We're not operating and understanding that, I mean, you know, I don't mean to be rude, but you're right. I mean, blacks just do not have the same potential as whites, generally speaking, or other races for that matter. You know,
On average.
And that's obvious. Like, I went to school with blacks, and I mean, it's like, geez, of course, yeah. Like, most of these kids are not going to amount to much. They're incompetent. They can't read. They can't barely write. They're dysfunctional. They're out of control in many cases, you know, fighting and yelling at the teacher and stuff. Everybody knows this growing up, but our policy is, you know, formulated around this fairy tale that we're all the same, we all have the same potential, and nobody is ever held to account. That's the biggest problem, in my opinion, is that we are just no longer holding people accountable for their own actions. We are not enforcing the law as it should be. And this goes back, this precedes, this idea that we're not enforcing the law, this precedes everything that we've seen in the past 6 months. This goes back, I mean, I really look at, like, think about back in, like, 2015 when Trump was holding rallies and there was riots and looting and people getting attacked. And, you know, nobody was held accountable for that criminality. You know, it's like you let this sort of stuff fester and sprout up and it's going to take over your whole country. And that's where we're at right now.
Yeah. Portland is great. I mean, what they do is, you know, they get arrested. and they don't hold them in jail. They don't make them even put up bail a lot of times. So they're on the street the next day, and they just keep going back and back. Meanwhile, it's destroyed the downtown business community. And you've got all this property damage, and every night there's riots going down to residential sections and screaming at the residents. It's just, they have carte blanche practically. If you're not going to arrest them, what these people are going to do it. They're going to keep going.
It's just like, what are the police doing? Well, in many cases, the police are, they have their hands tied by the mayor or by the police chief, who's basically in bed with all of this, right? I mean, I'm fairly convinced at this point that the whole COVID situation and then the George Floyd situation, this is all designed to undermine Trump. I mean, really, at the end of the day, that's the way the media and the left-wing establishment, the Democrats, they're clearly using these opportunities to just destroy and create chaos and havoc. And I mean, they've already been doing that his whole presidency. And I'm no, like, Trump-loving, you know, sycophant or anything like that. You know, I think he's got a lot of problems. But at the end of the day, I think that the left views him as, like, a very serious threat to their agenda. And I think he potentially is, but I think he's got a lot of very bad advisors. But still, I mean, that doesn't change the fact that the mainstream left views him as like a Nazi, basically, as like the next Hitler, and they openly say this.
Really? The orange Nazi, and there's never been a president hated so much, and I think it's energized the left. You can say, well, that's sort of a negative there. And Trump has a lot, you know, he could have been a lot better. I wish, he could have somebody, censoring his, or sort of shaping his tweets a little better. And why hasn't he tried to end birthright citizenship? Why isn't, it doesn't a whole lot of things he could have tried to do. He is a breath of fresh air. The entire establishment, left to right, top to down, hate him. Just today, there's something on Twitter. I saw something, I think James Kirkpatrick tweeted that there's some letter, 350 former Bush, Romney, and McCain, staffers had signed a letter, endorsing Biden. And that there's just so many Republicans that are tied into that, wishy-washy conservative, really wouldn't make any difference who's president. And I think that's what they wanted. They wanted Hillary versus Jeb Bush. That would have been their ideal thing. And they got Trump. I'm like, absolutely crazy. Because his rhetoric scares the hell out of them. Whatever his actions, his rhetoric was about diversity, immigration, Mexico said not sending the best people, things he said about illegal aliens and talking about cutting back legal immigration. Oh man, that's just anathema to these people. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, when he first, in that very first debate, I still remember this vividly because I was just totally like, I almost fell off my chair when I was watching it, when he's in the debate saying, look, I do not have time for total political correctness. And he's like, I'm like, what? What is he saying? And then he starts talking about illegal, we're gonna build a wall and we're gonna deport all these people.
Yeah.
So I mean, this sort of rhetoric, it's to us. There obviously there's much more that needs to be done and much more that needs to be followed through upon. By the way, he hasn't really done much that he said he was gonna do.
Yeah, exactly.
But just the rhetoric alone is, I totally agree with you. I think that's really the big story of Trump and his candidacy and his presidency and potentially his second, presidency, which is why I do want to see him get elected. I've lost a lot of hope in him, just because, he's just, well, I don't know. I see it both ways, because sometimes like I see him and I'm like, wow, I'm inspired again. And then other times I'm so disappointed. So it's like, he almost is, I don't know. I still, I just have mixed feelings about the whole situation. I definitely want to see him in office over Joe Biden. Let's be clear about that.
Yeah, yeah, let's be clear about that, because he really is. The radical left associated with the Democratic Party is not the Democratic Party that we knew even a few years ago. They are way out there, and who has grown up, the Democrats were the party of labor unions and working class people. Not anymore. White working class is definitely for Trump.
Yeah, well, we will see what's going to happen here. We only got about, what, 2 more months before the election, and this year has been nothing but chaos and just, oh my gosh.
You think of a lot of white people would be waking up because of that. You know, I mean, I know these other networks are not highlighting all the violence. So maybe people don't know, but Republicans can definitely, this is a good Republican talking point, law and order. And just emphasize how these Democrat-run cities, and they're doing that. It's a refrain now. But
yeah, well, you know what it is? I mean, I think, in my experience, I think most people just don't, they don't know where to get their information. Even people that are on our side, basically, more or less on our side, they still get trapped by the media. They still fall for the media bullshit. I mean, and the media is very, very instrumental in all of this. I mean, as you said, you know, whites are literally, I mean, whites are being brutalized, attacked, denigrated at virtually every level of society. There's no media coverage. There's no national protests. There's not even anybody, like, in the political system. There's no sympathetic political figure to this, including Trump, which is dumbfounding to me. I mean, Trump could be making this an issue, but he's not. I mean, think about, for example, just, I think it was just last night in Minneapolis, which has basically been destroyed as a result of all the riots since the George Floyd situation, the riots and looting, I should add. From what I understand, anyways, based on the news coverage and statements from the police department there, a murder suspect, literally like a black guy who had just been suspected of murdering somebody, is fleeing from police. The guy commits suicide because he's basically been trapped, and the whole city is looted because they think. And no, I haven't seen anybody even mention this in the media. You know, I only know because I know where to look. I know how, you know, I'm on Twitter, I'm on, you know, different websites and stuff. I have access to good, legitimate information. But people don't even, like, mainstream Trump supporting people, they don't even realize this. They don't even know about it.
Yeah.
So it's a real problem. that to me is the major problem. People still do have good instincts and they see what's going on is wrong. They just don't have access to the information and the perspectives that they need to hear.
Which is why Jewish involvement in the media is so important, and why they want to shut down Twitter and YouTube and Facebook. You know, they know that that's a critical thing. And if they were to succeed, yeah, you'd never hear about white people getting murdered, like that 5-year-old kid that was executed the other day.
Tucker Carlson and, I mean, Fox News, I guess, some of the hosts actually did cover it, but it's almost fine. Nobody else.
Fox is pretty, relatively good, no question. But most people are watching NBC, CBS, CNN, MSNBC. Yeah, all those people are. And then an awful lot of people don't watch anything. They don't know about this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, really, that's kind of where I'm at right now. It's like, people just don't know. And it's so much to try to get people caught up on to understand really what's going on. It's almost like, God, where do I even start? You know, I try to keep it basic and like point out basic things. But I'm saying, like, for example, the situation in Minneapolis, or like explaining what really happened with this guy in Kenosha, who, according to the Wisconsin Department of Justice, I mean, the cops were called because he was basically not allowed to be around his ex-girlfriend or something, from what I understand. They were attempting to arrest him. He started fighting with them and basically resisting their orders. He's not obeying what they're trying to tell him to do. They attempt to taser him, and he proceeds to walk around his vehicle. So basically, this guy is not cooperating at all.
No.
And yet, it's still, people still, like, are, like, outraged at the cops. And I'm like, oh my God. And they just don't know. They don't know the details. Because the media will not even report on this at all. You have to go on the DOJ of Wisconsin's Twitter feed to even find anything about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That cop in Kenosha is going to have a defense as well, because that guy seems to have been going for a knife.
Yeah. Well, and he may have even had a knife on him. I mean, that's still not totally clear yet.
So all that video of what was of the wrestling beforehand. I tell you, being a cop is the toughest job in the world now. You know, down in Georgia, there was this cop shot a black woman. Well, you know, she wouldn't follow orders. He wanted to arrest her. And so finally he, I don't think he shot her. He wrestled her down or something.
He tased her. He used a taser.
Yeah, he used a taser.
Yeah, I saw the video, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, and that's just horrible. And he got fired right off the bat. What the hell is he supposed to do? Wrestle her down? That'd be another thing. What's he supposed to do? Shoot her? Certainly not that. So what are you supposed to do in a situation like that? You just let, it'd be like in Kenosha, you just let the guy drive away. Okay, bye.
See, I know that's the thing, and we've seen in all of these situations, I mean, especially recently, but even going back to like Trayvon Martin and all the other big high profile events that started a lot of these riots, you see like the elite media, the elite political establishment almost instantly call for like arrests. Like you think about like the George Floyd thing, the mayor, by the way, the Jewish mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, I think is his name. He's like, like the same day this happens, there's not even been an investigation. He's openly calling for for these officers to be fired, to be charged with murder. And that's of course exactly what happened. Yeah. So there's just like no sense of rule of law. There's no sense of objectivity of, you know, anybody being held accountable for their actions. It's all just blamed on white racism and systemic racism and white privilege and all this other nonsense. And what's sad is that Trump and the GOP won't even fight back against this when they easily could, when they very easily could.
Sad, but true. Yeah, very true.
Yeah, it's pretty it's pretty tough. I mean, we talked a year and a half ago, and we thought it was bad then. Geez, look at it now. You know, one last question I have for you, and I don't know if you even are aware of it, but are you familiar with the National Justice Party that was recently announced by Mike Enoch?
I just saw a little bit about it. I don't know much about it.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I've always been sort of a fan of them, and, you know, I think it's because I don't think we're going to find any sort of political solutions with the GOP, certainly. I don't know if there are any political solutions at all at this point, but this to me is a step in the right direction. A party that's openly speaking how we would speak, essentially, you know, openly championing the interests of white people and, you know, concerning themselves with the interests of whites and just America in general, I guess, and the truth. I mean, that's a huge thing as well. So I was pretty inspired when I saw this speech, you know, kind of announcing the party. I don't know much, you know, the details or what's going on behind the scenes or whatever, but I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. They're obviously not going to, like, you know, mount a candidacy against President Trump at this point or anything like that, but I think it's a step in the right direction. I mean, I think at some point it's going to have to come to this. It's going to take a real sacrifice, just like it always has in any political situation like this. So just curious your thoughts about it. I mean, I don't know if you know much about it or whatever.
Well, yeah, I'm associated with the American Freedom Party, and it was a similar idea. I go to meetings every year or two. And, but, you know, it's very, very hard to start a party. You know, it's hard to get on the ballots. It's hard to do anything. And, of course, the establishment hates us. But, I think, you know, everybody should try this kind of thing. I think it's good. I, I think that we're headed for some kind of civil war kind of situation. I don't think we can talk to each other anymore. I think it's just really, really bad. And I don't think it's going to change much. It's just like the Civil War, you know, the first Civil War where, you know, people couldn't talk anymore to each other. Complete division.
Well, that's definitely where we're at right now. I mean, you just cannot have an honest conversation with your political opponents anymore. I mean, that's pretty obvious at this point.
Or your own family sometimes, quite often. Sadly.
True. Well, Dr. McDonald, I appreciate you taking the time. It's always a good conversation. I really do appreciate it. So.
I hate to be such a downer, but I have to say I'm a little down right now. But I do think that, yeah, I never give up, and we ought to keep going, do what we can.
And you know,
because we have a lot of things on our side. I mean, an awful lot of white people are not liking what they're seeing, and I think more and more are identifying with our issues, even though maybe not explicitly quite yet. One of the things we didn't talk about was, you know, the Obama administration's policy of building Section 8 housing in the suburbs. Well, that is not going to be popular with liberal whites either. And an awful lot of white people are going to be really worried about those kinds of issues. To think that there'd be a Section 8 housing and you have a lot of welfare black type people in their neighborhood, that is not going to go. And Trump rescinded that. And I think that is going to be something that is going to get more and more white people thinking about these issues.
Yeah, no, I sure hope so. I mean, it's amazing to me, like, still that, like, people can't see through this stuff. But again, I guess when the media is not explaining it, not presenting the facts in a fair way, you know, it's pretty tough.
Yeah, it's pretty tough.
But I guess, you know, life is really a struggle in general, and at least we're fighting on the right side and trying to stand up for what's right. So that's what gives me hope and inspires me, is just knowing that we're trying to do the right thing, the honest thing, and to stand up for not only for our people, but just for truth and sanity in the world. I mean, at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. Yep. Cool. Well, thank you, sir. I appreciate it. I hope all is well. We'll have to do this again. Maybe after the election, we could have a little, have another podcast and have a discussion about whatever happens at that point. Who knows? Everything has been happening so quickly in the past 6 months or 7 months or whatever. It's sure going to get crazy in the next two.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Okay.
Nice talking to you, John.
Yeah. Nice talking to you, too. You take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.